This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm delighted to introduce our keynote speaker, Mark Schlissel, who's the 14th president of the University of Michigan. Mark, of course, is no stranger to the Berkeley campus. He joined Berkeley's faculty in 1999 in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology. That means I must have signed his appointment letter. He became dean of the biological sciences, a position in which he served until he became provost at Brown in 2011. A graduate of Princeton and Johns Hopkins, where he earned both a PhD and an MD degree, he started his faculty career at Johns Hopkins. His research is focused on the developmental biology of B lymphocytes, the cell type in the immune system that secretes antibodies. He's interested in understanding the genetic factors involved in the production of antibodies and how mistakes in that process can lead to leukemia and lymphoma. In his inaugural address as president of the University of Michigan, President Schlissel said, "I've been a professor, a dean, a provost, and now a president. But first and foremost, I am a lifelong student, and as such, I am inherently curious." That lifelong curiosity has shaped his vision of the university, one that's based, again in his words, on a love of learning, a longing for discovery, and a commitment to pursue the truth. Particularly significant for his leadership, first at Berkeley and now at Michigan, and for his role in this conference, is his commitment to the public university as a bedrock principle, a privilege, and a responsibility. Again, his words. For President Schlissel, that means commitment to research and teaching that meet the most pressing needs of our global society. And it involves a special obligation to extend the reach of the university's teaching and research across the full breadth of society. He said in his inaugural address, "Michigan's house must be big and its doors open wide." I love that image. It's a really wonderful image. The critical challenge for today's public universities, achieving the highest level of research and teaching excellence, not through exclusivity, but inclusivity, leveraging the experiences and perspectives of the broadest possible diversity of students, faculty, and staff, has inspired his leadership and makes him an ideal speaker for our conference. President Schlissel.
Thank you very much, Carol. That was an incredibly kind introduction. And I am not embarrassed to admit that I still have the letter you signed. My appointment letter to Berkeley is something that I will always cherish and carry with me. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for the very kind introduction. This talk will be, you know, a little bit different than what came earlier because I'm not a scholar of education. Carol said, I'm a laboratory biologist, a medical doctor. I've taught undergrads, graduate students, and medical students. And I've taken a pathway to academic leadership. So I'm going to spend about half my time giving you an academic leader's perspective on the direction of undergraduate education at a research university. I'll contrast Michigan and Berkeley a lot, two of my favorite places. Anybody here get their degree from Michigan or was ever at Michigan as a student or a faculty member? Okay, good. It must be the California thing. Usually I do that and lots of hands go up.
My father did.
Oh, that counts.
I grew up near Ann Arbor.
Oh, yeah, that counts. That counts as well. And then I'll spend some of my time talking about some work that's going on at the University of Michigan of a more quantitative nature, using big data analytics to think about ways to understand how our students are doing and to individualize or personalize their education, even at the remarkable scale of a great public university. So as many similarities as they are between Michigan and Berkeley, there are some notable differences. One big one I was speaking a little bit about out in the hall a moment ago, and that's the University of Michigan has an academic medical center and a medical school. That's a huge difference. 45% of our budget is health system and medical school budget. The university health system sees 2.1 million patient visits a year, a 1,000-bed hospital, 3,000 clinical faculty. So that gives you a sense of the scaling factor that comes when you have an academic medical center. The second big difference, which is interesting to think about, especially in the current era of challenges to public higher ed nationally and certainly here at Berkeley, is governance. Governance is very different. So, of course, here there's a system president and a board of regents at Berkeley that are appointed by the governor or serve in an ex officio fashion for 12-year terms, the appointees. So the chancellor here is really a step or two removed from the governance of the system. Where I work at the University of Michigan, there's a publicly elected board of regents that I am responsible to. They hired me. We meet monthly. They're all over me. There are eight of them, statewide popular vote. So that's very interesting to think about. They get nominated through the political parties. They're Dems or Republicans. 8-year terms, two of them will come up. Two positions open up every 2 years, so staggered 8-year terms. So very interesting. Small group, eight people. Right now there are 7 lawyers and 1 medical doctor. So very different form of governance. There are 15 public colleges and universities in the state of Michigan. I'm responsible for the Ann Arbor campus that you're very familiar with, as well as the Flint and Dearborn campuses of the University of Michigan. Those two campuses are quite different. They're regional universities that serve a very different demographic, much more educationally and less research-focused relative to Ann Arbor, which, of course, is amongst the most research-intensive universities that there is. A third difference between Berkeley and Michigan that took a little bit of adjusting to for me is football. Wow, people go really serious. Here, I was here during the era when Aaron Rodgers was the quarterback and the team was doing really well. And, you know, some people cared, some people didn't care. They're pretty California laid back about sports. In Michigan, if the team does poorly, I have a terrible week at work. And when the team does well, and you wouldn't think about it, but yeah, I would get emails and phone calls from federal judges and from CEOs and hedge fund people, you know, very accomplished people in society who wanted to tell me what to do with a football coach. So that, you know, level of sports culture was very interesting and surprising. Amongst the similarities, which is very advantageous to me, is, you know, we share the same colors, right? Yellow and blue. But of course, I had to learn, instead of say golden, I had to say maize and blue. So I had to adjust a little bit. But really, the most important thing we share is a mission, a great public mission. All universities do teaching, research, and service. But this is the mission statement of the University of Michigan. So to serve the people of Michigan and the world through preeminence in creating, communicating, preserving, and applying knowledge, art, and academic values in developing leaders and citizens who challenge the present and enrich the future. So on my very worst day, all I need to do is read this, and I've got bounce back in my step, and that is the greatness of this university as well. I remember one of my former colleagues here that I consider a mentor and a friend, Bob Bergineau, is famously quoted as saying, the world has lots of great private universities. What it needs is great public universities. And I really strongly believe in that as well. Now, we have very significant advantages, despite often walking around with our head in our hands. We've got tremendous scale. We've got 43,000 students at Michigan. About 29,000 of those are undergrads. We've got 3,000 clinical faculty and 3,000 tenure stream faculty. So 19 schools and colleges, major research institutes. So that's remarkable scale and breadth. We also have this mingling on the same campus of undergraduates, graduate, and professional education. And that, too, is a huge advantage for education on a campus. And then finally, as I mentioned, we have this academic medical center. Now, the challenges are similarly obvious to this audience here, but for decades now, there's been an ongoing disinvestment by states in higher education. My own university, if you just look at nominal dollars, we're getting the same amount of money from Michigan that we got in 1997. If you adjust for inflation, it goes back to the 1960s, the amount of money we're getting from the state. So just as here, there's been an erosion of this compact with the public between public higher education as a common good. Of course, we've also been suffering in recent years. This year looks a little better, but it may not last. Flat and decreasing federal research funding. We have the challenges of public governance, some of which I alluded to. They're happening here and obvious all the time. We've been particularly challenged developing a diverse faculty and a diverse student body by many parameters. And we're living in a world with academic disciplines and structures that are centuries old, and they're not particularly well aligned with many of the most interesting and exciting emerging opportunities. Now, I very often get asked, and I speak in front of parent groups trying to recruit their kids to the University of Michigan, or when I was a dean here, trying to recruit their children here to Berkeley. What I tell people when they say, what's special about a public research university? I think of three things. The first and most important is the faculty. You get to learn from faculty that are defining what the edges are and what the next questions are of human knowledge and understanding. That's a different kind of instruction. You learn as a student that knowledge isn't static. There are things we think we know that are right and things we think we know, thought we knew that are wrong. But this idea that you can be an active participant in discovery is a fundamental difference between education at a major research university like Berkeley or Michigan and education at many of the other 3,000 or so colleges and universities in the United States. You get to participate in that, as we heard earlier, in a very engaged setting in ways that really change lives. I started out in college wanting to be a medical doctor, one of these kids programmed from childhood that I should grow up to be a doctor, put up a shingle, and be like Dr. Kildare on television. I'm dating myself. During college, I got to work as a volunteer in a research lab, a biology research lab, and it completely changed my life. And that experience is replicated again and again at this university and others. The second distinctive thing, because of our breadth and scale and because we're largely residential, even though all the students don't live in housing we own, the students live in proximity to the campus. Learning happens continuously, and a ton of the learning is out of the campus. It's out of the classroom. They're learning in clubs, as we heard, in the eateries, in the dormitories, at intramurals, on the playing fields, participating and watching athletic events. They're learning absolutely continuously, and only a fraction of that is in the classroom. And you don't get that in a sort of commuter-like educational environment. And then finally, it is the scale and the breadth of the place that's an enormous advantage. You send your kid to a research university like Michigan or Berkeley, there's almost nothing they might be interested in that they can't find to study. So it's that breadth that's really an exciting, distinctive component of our great public research universities. Now, I've thought a lot as I've risen into higher levels of leadership about what it is we really want to teach our students. So historically, what we learned in school, the 20th century skill set. We learned to extract meaning from text and narrative, to write clearly, to communicate well. We learned quantitative reasoning, critical thinking, and we picked a discipline to dive more deeply into. And all too often ignored, we also aspire to teach citizenship. That's the sort of leaders in your community component of the mission of a great public university. If you look at this, and I'll talk more about this in a moment, this is the liberal arts skill set, right? Yeah. This is the set of basic tools that people need to function, whether they're a nuclear engineer or a poet. This is what they need, and this is what we aspire to teach. Now, in the 21st century, the old school set skill set remains important. But now you have to add things in our knowledge economy like creativity, teaching creativity, entrepreneurship, how to work in teams and collaborate, self-agency and innovation, teaching someone not to need someone standing next to them telling them what to do, and interestingly, very importantly, intercultural intelligence. We are headed towards being a majority-minority society, or a true melting pot, as we were in earlier eras in our country. And all of our students, to be well-educated and function at a high level in society, need experience and expertise engaging across difference, being able to see the world from other people's eyes, engage with people that think differently than they do, learn how to relate when there's fundamental disagreement or lack of commonality in background. Those characteristics require that we build diverse campuses. There are many reasons, and we've been making a major effort at Michigan in this regard, as does Berkeley, for several reasons, and I'll just enumerate them briefly. The first is, as a public institution, I think ethically we should look like the public we serve. And I'm not just talking race and ethnicity, I'm talking socioeconomic status, gender identity and preference, diversity of political thought, which we're justly criticized for quite often in the academy, geographical diversity, building a community that looks like the state and then the nation that we're serving. As I mentioned earlier, students learn from one another both inside the classroom and outside the classroom. You don't learn as much if you're coming from the same background, you're listening to the same radio or whatever online music people listen to now, and watching the same media, individualizing your news feeds from sources that agree with you. You're not going to learn as much. That's another reason we need to thoughtfully build diversity. There's also a great academic literature on the robustness of decision-making and creativity that comes from diverse groups. There's a guy at Michigan, Scott Page, but there are many other people that have studied this rigorously. Groups that are diverse come up with more complex and creative solutions to challenging problems. So we need to build a campus that establishes that environment. And then finally, once again, we need to prepare our students to function in this increasingly multicultural world. Now, part of our mission is to work to the public benefit, and we have an obligation, I think, to serve society by focusing on scholarship and creative work of benefit to the public. Now, of course, many of us who are professors at universities and leaders at universities know you can't tell a professor what to study, and you wouldn't want to, right? You want a professor to follow their passions and follow their interests. But as I ripen into my leadership at Michigan, what I'm discovering is I can add incremental resources to incentivize people to do things. Everybody deserves the basic tools they need to be a productive scholar in their field, but I can make exceptional investments in a way that promotes the values that I'll speak a little bit more about. The connections between public benefit and research are sometimes easier told in the STEM story. I think that's part of why STEM fields have become increasingly sexy, and politicians talk about it, and parents want their kids to study it, thinking that they're going to do something useful, and the research that we do in engineering labs or in biomedical labs are going to lead to cures for diseases. But I'll tell you, the major problems that we're confronting in society today, they're political and social problems. And it's really the arts and the humanities that are less appreciated, but at least as impactful for a great research university. I'm a huge believer in the importance of the continued investment and promotion of the liberal arts. It teaches this basic skill set, I said, the 20th century plus skill set, a deeper appreciation of the human experience, a more interesting and satisfying life, perhaps. It prepares students to be citizens in their community, to be leaders, to provoke discussions amongst their neighbors, to have thoughtful dialogue in their families, in their workplaces, in their communities. And it prepares students to take on these greatest challenges, which I think in the short term are social and political ones. You know, we can develop a new drug and help a new category of patients achieve a greater quality of life, but if we don't figure out the social aspects of stemming global warming, from a social perspective, from a human perspective, it doesn't matter how many new drugs we develop, for example. If President Bush had sitting next to him somebody with a sense of religion and culture and history of the Middle East and Iraq and its neighbors, perhaps history would have played out dramatically differently. So these are as important as being an engineer and a physicist a chemist or a biologist. Sorry, Steve, if you're still here. Okay, no, sorry. So it also turns out that liberal arts students end up all out through the economy. So I'm going to try to go to a website in a second, but what this is a way of representing where students who had a certain major end up professionally. So along this side are liberal arts majors like psychology, political science, economics, history, communications, sociology, anthropology, and they track out to professions like law, finance, technology, marketing, etc. And I'm not going to take the time. There's a website we have where what you can do is click on a department history, and then you could see all the different professions that historians end up in. And I find this extremely useful when I'm making the political argument or the argument to parents. You know, send your kids to a great university, have them study something that truly excites them. They're going to do fine. They're going to develop a general skill set and the kind of knowledge that employers love to have. When I was at Brown, one of our board members was a guy named Brian Moynihan. And Brian is the CEO of the Bank of America. And what he was fond of saying is people with quantitative skills, the bank can hire very easily. There are tons of physicists and mathematicians, and they find them at places like Berkeley. However, for him to find people with communication skills, cultural sensitivity, folks that can write, people that can work in teams, people with leadership skills, that's extremely hard. And they look to the liberal arts majors for that purpose. So as I make my investments at Michigan in the years ahead in research and teaching, I think of the 20th century model of a research university driven by disciplines: English, history, psychology, molecular biology, chemistry, physics. The 21st century, I truly think, if we're really going to get the most out of our investment in research universities, research and teaching-wise, is driven by problems. And problems have this annoying tendency not to know what discipline is supposed to study them. They're just problems. And if we're so narrow that we'll only use the tools of an economist or the tools of a philosopher or the tools of an English scholar, then we're very unlikely to really make a fundamental contribution to solving a major societal problem. And that really is our mission. Scholars do the research that turns them on. But for me, a great public university should incentivize its faculty to come together around great societal problems. So my challenge as a university leader is, how do I help evolve our academic structures to best serve this public mission? At Michigan, we're doing many things. Some of them are quite similar to what you're doing here. So we have a data science initiative that consists of strong efforts in precision medicine, transportation. So since Michigan is the sort of heart of the classical transportation industry with Ford and GM and what used to have Chrysler, autonomous vehicle research is big, and all the data that comes with censoring up highways and cars. We're doing a lot of work in learning analytics that I'll speak about, and we have a great institute for social research. Some of the greatest demographers are at Michigan, so we're investing in a data science infrastructure and programs of this nature, but they cut across the campus. We started a few years ago an institute for healthcare policy and innovation. Turns out 12 of our 19 schools have faculty members in this institute. So you think about it, medical doctors, of course, and nurses and pharmacy school people, but the School of Social Work, the School of Public Policy, law, business, education, everything. So the beauty of a great research university is when we can tap into this breadth to bring people together to focus on problems, and then wrap educational programs around these problems in an engaged sort of way. We've begun something just now called the Humanities Collaboratory. And you know, this really might be the fault of me as a biomedical scientist. But in the humanities, it seems, people don't collaborate very much. So folks seem to publish single author books. Doctoral students eventually publish their PhD book down the road as a single author. Teams don't tend to come together. So we have invested in an effort within our Humanities Center to begin something that the Provost calls the Humanities Collaboratory. And they're picking out a handful of problems for humanistic scholars to work on collaboratively, to co-publish about. So things like a project on mass incarceration, digital inequalities, disability and its cultures, translation, visual culture and visual citizenship. So really very interesting areas as an experiment to see if we can provoke the same kind of collaborative activity perhaps that is so familiar in the sciences and some of the social sciences, and see whether the humanities scholars embrace this as a mode of scholarship. Another thing I'm doing that I stole from Berkeley is my efforts on bioscience. Steve, you'll have to remind me, what did we call this group that had all the representatives of the different biology leaders? CACB, the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Biology. And I participated in that when I was here as a dean. And the idea was that would be a coordinating body to capture synergies amongst the breadth of a campus where people are doing biology in many different places. At Michigan is even more of that. So, of course, we have these thousands of med school faculty, a pharmacy school, a public health school. But we've got bioengineering and chemical engineering and, of course, chemistry and physics, math and statistics, a school of information. The list goes on and on. And if you add it all up, of our 3,000 tenure stream faculty, over 1,000 of them are doing life science work for at least part of their portfolio. And over 50% of the dollars that Michigan spends on research are biology and biomedical dollars. Yet the 19 schools and colleges are making the decisions all on their own. And I discovered last year that we were recruiting for biochemists in three different colleges, in three different departments, advertising in the same issue and competing with one another for the same candidates. How embarrassing is that, right? I also walked in to a committed building project for the equivalent of MCB in the Literature, Sciences, and the Arts College, the Liberal Arts Corps of Michigan, a $262 million life science building, kind of like the Li Ka-shing building here, for two big biology departments in the Liberal Arts College. All of the planning for that building went on without any input from biomedical scientists, from bioengineers, from public health people, from pharmacy school people. Not even a discussion, what areas are you going to be investing in the coming years? And you're making a $260 million investment in a building. So I've set up something like the CACB. I'm making all my investments in life science through this group. I'm not investing in schools and colleges incrementally. I'm investing in this group. All the schools and colleges that are doing life science will bring their best ideas forward to this group and compete for these resources. And the idea is that one of the competition criteria is what can you do in synergy or in leverage to other schools and colleges in similar areas. So it's like the CACB, but with money. Yeah. Now, a challenge at research universities, and I felt it here, and I think if we're honest, we'd all admit this, and I feel it to felt it to an extent at Brown, which is a very education-oriented private university, it's sometimes challenging to incentivize faculty to apply the same levels of creativity that they do to their research to their teaching. So here and at Michigan, if you're an outstanding researcher and an adequate teacher, you do great. And I don't know if I'm speaking out of school. You have to take your teaching responsibilities seriously. But at many research universities, there isn't the same communal aspiration to be great at teaching. So I'm working on this. How do I incentivize faculty to apply creativity to teaching? So one way is these research, cross-cutting research adventures that we're investing in. The biological sciences one, the mobility transformation one, the health policy innovation one, have educational programs wrapped around them. So part of bringing these groups together will include graduate and undergraduate programs. We have many competitive internal funding programs for people who want to do novel educational experiments. Faculty love to compete. They love to win. So you put out a pot of money and you actually can incentivize people to do things that they might not have done otherwise. We also do a lot of celebrating faculty teaching. We've got a special endowed chairs program that it's really virtual chairs. You know, there isn't real money behind them, but we put a little money in. That we name our best dozen teachers campus-wide every year. We do a huge celebration, and they become like a collegium of outstanding teachers. Again, it motivates people. People sort of compete for this honor. It's real currency in the community. And then we have built a number of core resources, like core facilities to a scientist, core resources to support teaching and experiments in teaching. Some of these efforts are mixed research and teaching efforts. I'll tell you about a couple for fun. One I'll tell you about first is called M cubed. Michigan has this annoying tendency to make everything M something or other. So this is M cubed. But it's extreme. I wish I had thought of this. It's extremely clever. Every faculty member, every tenure stream faculty member, got a virtual token worth $20,000. You can't do anything with that token. You can't cash it in unless you find two other faculty members, one of whom has to come from a different school or college, who want to do a project together. That project has to spend half its money on education, either at the graduate or undergraduate level. And you put three tokens together, you get $60,000, and you can try an interesting idea. Now, in some disciplines, $60,000 isn't a lot of money. In other disciplines, it's a ton of money. This has been enormously popular at Michigan. We've gone through multiple rounds of this. The faculty called cubing, so they've really embraced this. And it's led to, as you might imagine, like many seed funding programs, several-fold greater external dollars coming into these programs once they get started. So that's been really fun and successful. Like Berkeley Center for Teaching and Learning, Michigan as a center for research on learning and teaching, provides pedagogy support. What we're gearing up to have it do for us now, in alignment with our efforts on diversity and inclusion, is to begin a program where all new faculty have to take a pedagogy course learning how to manage a diverse and inclusive classroom. And, you know, those of us that teach, the stories you hear about students who are the only kid who looks like them in a class. And you turn to a kid and they're providing the African-American perspective on some issue. Why on earth is it their responsibility to speak for, you know, a huge array of people that may or may not share any opinions or beliefs or background with them? But there are skills involved in teaching in a diverse classroom environment. And we're taking advantage of this very good Center for Research, Learning, and Teaching. I'll speak more in a few minutes, but we have a Digital Education and Innovation Center. This was, you know, begun in two sorts of modes. One is it's the place where we built up the capacity to develop online components of courses, MOOCs, edX, these type of things, Coursera. But maybe more importantly, to really help faculty build technology into their on-campus classes, and then to become the home for data analytics when it comes to looking at our curriculum. And I'll show you some of their data in a few minutes. So this is Digital Education and Innovation. Full-time staff. You know, one of the beauties of scale, comparing my experience at Brown and at Michigan, you know, Brown's a wealthy Ivy League university, but it only has 6,000 undergrads and 700 faculty. So it's a small. When you have the scale of a Berkeley or of a Michigan, you can pull together enough resources to develop very robust service centers, places that can provide academic support at all different levels. I was very enamored as I was leaving here years ago, and hopefully it's still continuing. LNS was developing its Big Ideas courses, which were great fun. It's a similar sort of thing, trying to stimulate creativity in teaching. Tony Cascardi's Townsend Center, when he was leading Townsend, began this Course Threads program that I thought was also a very creative way for faculty to consider the curriculum. So this Third Century Initiative is another seed funding program where the provost was able to put aside $25 million to stimulating creative new approaches to teaching. Two categories. One that she called quick wins, small-scale projects. You apply, you'd give out, you know, 20 or 25 of them every semester. And then a much smaller number of big transformative grants. These smaller ones are things like transforming arts and artists in the age of digital media, leveraging technology to reach audiences in new ways, a living lab program that took advantage of our many museums, our libraries, more as teaching tools than we usually do. But then these larger programs, Michigan has a biology field station, and they successfully competed and won $1 million out of this fund to develop multidisciplinary courses that take advantage of summer residencies at this field station up in north central Michigan on a beautiful lake. And these courses engage students from biology, ecology, climate science, public health, engineering, urban planning, art and design, and humanists and social scientists as well. Field-based research projects focusing on solving environmental problems and sustainability. Another winning proposal at a scale of about $1 million was something called the Michigan Engaging Communities Through the Classroom program. This is, again, a multidisciplinary group of faculty that teach a series of courses in areas where there are societal problems. So this one in particular has to do with renewing urban revitalization for neighborhoods in Detroit. They do classroom work talking about the different tools that are available for doing proactive community engaged learning. They go ahead and interview potential clients in the community. They develop projects together, and then they begin to implement. And again, it's involving disciplines like architecture and urban planning, engineering, public policy, law, and business. And the faculty that win the $1 million get very excited about it, as you might imagine. So at Michigan, a year ago, our data was about 48% of students by the time they graduate have participated in faculty research. I'd say probably half of this is laboratory research, and the other half is all the different kinds of research students can be involved in. 72% had done community service by the time of graduation. 27% right now are doing study abroad sometime during their 4+ years at Michigan. And about half are doing co-curricular activities, very much in alignment with the talk we heard a little bit earlier today. So I'm going to shift gears for the last part of this talk and speak about some of the data-driven and computational approaches we're using to try to do a better job educating these massive numbers of students in an era of financial constraint. And I think that as educators, we've been far slower to embrace the power of digital technology than we have been as scientists and as humanists and as social scientists. So I think we're late to the dance, but now many of us are recognizing the power of data to make our teaching better. Ultimately, what data will give us the power to do is to personalize education at scale, or at least that's our ambition. We've got to be able to attend to every one of our students. We've got to be able to measure and report what matters. And I think this is amongst our most challenging problems. The elements of that liberal education, we keep falling back to measuring grades and grade point average. And that's it says something, but it certainly doesn't capture a lot of what we're trying to imbue our students with. And then we've got to be able to do things at scale, at the scale of tens of thousands of students at a time. So in terms of improving student performance, the first step is to analyze the relationship between the background and performance in courses that students have completed, then identify students that are performing better or worse than expected, and then finally study these students, interviewing them, diving deeper, and say, what are the determinants of a student that actually outperforms what previous performance would have suggested they would do? The metric that's used to predict how a student should perform in a given class is their overall grade point average in all the other classes they've taken. And then we look in a particular class on how a student has done compared to in all their other classes. And you'll see from the data what I mean by that. So this is Econ 101, right? I don't know if it's called Econ 1 here or 101, but it's presumably macroeconomics, Econ 101. This actually represents data from 30,000 students. So this is the beauty of scale. Michigan has invested quite wisely in a data bank, a data storage facility. So dating back to the 1990s, we've got massive amounts of data every student, every class, every grade. It's really a remarkably robust and increasingly well-curated set of data. So on the x-axis is their grade point average in other courses. In the y-axis is their grades in Econ 101. What's plotted here is the mean grade in Econ 101 for each tranche of GPA in other courses. You see what I mean? So kids who have a 3.0 GPA actually, you know, have a 2.0 average grade in economics, for example. I'm not reading it very well, but you see what I mean. So each of these is a tranche of grade point average overall compared to how they did in this one big course. The dashed lines above and below are the one standard deviation lines. So, and then this solid purple line is the identity. So if a student did as well in econ as they did in all their other courses, then they would fall on this line. So what you can see is econ must be tough, right? Because what these scholars doing this, and I'll give some credits at the end, there's a grade point penalty for being in Econ 101. You know, it's about a half a grade point or 0.35 grade points below what they typically do elsewhere. This is a mean, and this is the error of the mean. You see how tight these bars are because we're dealing with 20 or 30,000 students. Up here, these are kids that are overperforming. What is it about them? Why are they overperforming? Down here are kids that are underperforming. What are they doing? What are the common characteristics of better than expected and worse than expected VT, W2E students? And thus far, the better than expected students change their approaches during class, emulating more successful students. The worse than expected become discouraged. They don't change. They kind of disengage. We were talking about academic engagement. There are also ways we can use this approach to uncover disparities between groups of students. These investigators have looked at gender, and this was very surprising to me. So same kind of plot. Now we've got men and women separated. The men are here in green, and the women are here in purplish blue. Look at that difference. You know, why is it that our women students, almost across the full spectrum in this difficult course with 30,000 data points here, why are they underperforming or at least being undergraded relative to men? And we've compared this with other universities. There's a group of universities that we call the CIC, the Center for Intercollegiate Cooperation or something. It's really the Big Ten, but we don't like to say Big Ten. And it's the same. It turns out in quantitatively intensive courses like economics, physics, and mathematics, there's a gender gap in the expected versus the observed between men and women. And this is, you know, we have to figure this out, right? And the investigator, Tim McKay, that's doing this study, thinks it has to do with how we're evaluating and grading people in a sexually dimorphic way. Now, what do we do to enhance the success of individual students? To change outcomes, we have to change behaviors. So you think of it like a public health or behavioral change intervention. One of the ways we're approaching this is with an online system that's being developed in this Digital Education and Innovation Center, the DEI Center, called eCoach, that is now scaled up to about 5,000 students, and we're going to expand to all students in 2016. So coaching is really important. 2 years ago, when I first started at Michigan, our football team was 5-7. Last year, our football team went 10-3. This is the guy we hired. So some of you may recognize him from the Bay Area, Jim Harbaugh. So, but, you know, aside from making the obligatory sports joke, the idea is that, you know, coaching matters, right? Coaches give students feedback, give student athletes feedback in real time. They give them encouragement. They keep an eye on them and make sure they're not sort of dogging it and falling off track. So to do that at scale is challenging, but the idea is to take a digital approach. So this is a system that students log on to for their performance in a particular class. It tells them all the different activities that are due on different dates for that class, how they've done on different things. It sort of keeps their schedule really focused. It makes suggestions on how to prepare for tests and for quizzes and for group activities. Then it provides information from former students that... let me just catch up with myself here. From previous students, what they think. So these students give advice. You know, do practice exams, start early, do the recommended homework. So they get these signals at different times during their course, one individual at a time. And then they get information from students that already finished the class saying how they wish they had done things better for that particular class. So a lot of students wish they started studying earlier. They wish they used a wider variety of resources. Specific concepts trip them up. I wish I practiced more for free response. I made careless mistakes. And this kind of coaches the students going through the class. The things that their peers screwed up on, they can theoretically pay particular attention to. And as we introduce this, we're going to study whether it's making a difference or it's being studied. We have a steering group led by our provost, but also with our head of our enrollment, our admissions leadership, and others, looking for other ways to apply data analytics to improve how we admit students and how we define success. I actually think admitting students to universities, certainly at Michigan and I imagine here, you rely on what's easy to measure, right? So we look at grades and we look at test scores. The news magazines tell us that's the right thing to look at because they reward that. And, you know, you get kids that are good at taking tests and have good grades in high school. Are those the kids that are the most talented kids that are going to get the most out of the education and serve the university's mission well? And we don't know. But we've taken this massive data repository and begin to ask these questions. We also can look more carefully. I showed you earlier a male versus female disparity, but we can look at disparities in outcomes between many different groups on many different axes using this big data bank. And finally, I heard mentioned earlier today, Michigan, like many universities, has learning communities, where a student will be in a engineers learning community or a French scholars learning community or a first-generation student living and learning community. Do those things make a difference? So we track the students compared to control students based on their performance during school using this massive data repository. So the first example I'll show you is student outcomes for those in different groups. We try to normalize for background, for grades in high school, and for ACT scores, and then we look at how admitted freshmen do, kids who were admitted in 2005, men and women, what their majors were and what their grades were. And if you look here, this is a heat map of grade point average. These are female students, and you can see they're all are largely in the yellow to green range, the 3 to 3.5 range. You can see how many women are studying psychology compared to sociology. You do the same thing for men, and you see a somewhat different distribution. The men's grades on average aren't quite as high. You see more of them perhaps in the natural sciences. But we could do this type of analysis on these hundreds of thousands of data points of how students are doing based on entry criteria, what majors they end up in, and then how they do in those majors to say, are we taking the right kids? Are we steering them in the right direction? The second is, how does the background at the time of admission affect the choice of a major? What's the probability of a student that's going to graduate with a major versus some measure of preparation? The easiest measure we used in this instance was ACT test scores, standardized test scores. So these are four different majors. The red in this instance are women. The darker color are men. This is the probability that a student's going to be a psychology major versus their ACT scores when they were admitted. So if you look, there's a pretty darn broad distribution among psychology majors of ACT scores. But look here at these math people. You know, these math people are people who end up in math or can graduate in math. You know, those ACT scores were pretty good predictors of their ability to make it through in math, way less so in psychology. You look at business, in business majors, it's not quite as extreme, but ACT scores are predictive to an extent of someone entering and then being able to make it through. And in other instances, they're not. So this can help us understand students on the way in the door and advise them well based on a very large cohort of predecessors. The last of these quantitative measures is interesting. Even though we require our students to pick a major, we also want them to educate themselves broadly. How do you measure how broadly a student is educating themselves at scale? How do you do this? So it turned out that a very smart undergrad was doing an independent study project and came up with a very nice quantitative measure of how broadly a student is studying in a curriculum. What he did is came up with a measure of how many connections a student had with every other student in his class, in his cohort. And he came up with a metric that compared random distributions of kids taking the same classes together as compared to the actual data. So a randomized virtual data set versus the actual data. And here's what you see. Students, and these are examples of three different majors. Students who are musical theater majors were almost only taking classes with other musical theater majors. These kids were not are not exploring the curriculum. The one exception way down here, so this is this measure of how broadly you're exploring the curriculum, this young man calls RPD. This is the frequency of students. This one student way down here was a joint musical theater and English major, and he's exploring the curriculum quite broadly. Philosophers are exploring things a bit more broadly. The kid who's the broadest is a philosopher and a pre-med. General studies at Michigan, there's a general studies major where it's a liberal arts major. You don't have to declare a concentration. You're taking a distribution of courses in the LSNA college, the Literature, Science, and the Arts College. And, you know, quite reassuringly, they're quite broad in their distribution. So this is a list of the least broad majors. This is the most broad major. So it's interesting. Music, dance, musical theater, music history. I don't know what it is about music. Music technology, music teacher education. And then amongst the more out there students who are all over the curriculum, psychologists, political scientists, economists, biologists, neuroscientists, engineers, and that's surprising. I wouldn't have guessed that. So we can try to find ways now to work with these students in music, theater, and dance school and find ways to incentivize or encourage them to get more out of college, perhaps, than only taking classes with other music students. As you can tell from these data figures I showed you, it's not very creative what we're measuring, right? We're measuring ACT and grades. We need way better metrics that align with the educational objectives so we can really measure the effectiveness of what we're doing. It was mentioned earlier today. I'm not a huge believer in asking students what they think they learned and whether they think they got smarter. I think there are all kinds of biases inherent in that approach. I think we should work as a community to coming up perhaps with more objective measures in alignment with these skills and characteristics we're trying to provoke in our students. The ideal metrics would allow us to measure change in knowledge and skills one student at a time from matriculation to graduation. And the wonderful consequence of that is it would allow us to escape the tyranny of the news magazines, which absolutely drives me crazy. My colleagues back in Michigan at 32nd Story are very excited in Michigan's law school. Just went from number 11, which was a travesty, because they've always been in the top 10, they went to number 8 from last year to this year. It's going to be released. It's embargoed. Don't tell anybody. It'll be out in a few days. But the ridiculous thing is that school is no better. It's the same school. We didn't hire new faculty. We didn't change the curriculum. It's the same school. The difference is we gave them a larger financial subsidy. So they took fewer students, driving up their dollars per student, increasing their LSAT average scores because we took fewer kids. We went less down on the list. And we subsidized fellowships for kids to employ them in the law within the first year of graduating, which is a criteria. All the schools are doing it. And now we went from 11 to 8. Everyone feels really good. So we've got to come up with much better ways to measure our success. The second and usually important area is access and affordability. Whenever I talk to groups in public, parents, citizens, this is invariably the question I get. Is college is too expensive? We can't afford it. I don't think my kid can get in. They're a good student. They try really hard. Berkeley is suffering this in real time. All publics are. We've got to get control of these cost drivers that are extremely difficult. A lot of this cost are faculty who are free agents. The faculty can move anywhere they want around the world, and we're competing with very wealthy universities to maintain outstanding faculty. The educational infrastructure is extremely expensive. We're involved, many of us, in a lifestyle arms race on campuses. I think we've invested in Michigan too much in very nice eateries and redone dorms, but you really can't say that because everyone else is doing it and the students expect that. Regulatory compliance is getting more expensive. The need to subsidize the research activity of faculty in these difficult times for federal funding. So a lot of cost drivers. We're also challenged with the politics of state funding, the unwillingness of the state to let the UC raise, Berkeley raise tuition, recognizing that a Berkeley degree might be worth more than a Merced degree and letting a bit of a market enter. That's just not allowed. That's a big political problem. We're also challenged with the inconsistency of public secondary education. I'm completely convinced that urban schools in particular, where kids are doing very poorly by many measures, there are as many talented, smart kids in those schools as there are in the schools that my children went to. What they don't have is the opportunity to achieve in ways we can recognize that achievement and then bring the most talented of them to our great research universities. So I think we have to find better ways to identify talented students from challenging circumstances where tests, ACT scores don't make it, grade point averages are very hard to assess, family circumstances are challenging. This is an enormous problem for us. And of course, with increasing income inequality and the growing need for financial aid, as we make our student bodies look more like the public we're serving, we have no idea how we're going to pay for it. And then finally, this governance challenge. We have to deal in every instance with a governor and a state legislature, either directly or indirectly. Regental oversight, the politics of tuition, the in-state, out-of-state ratio. So I don't know what UC is up to, what Berkeley is up to now. The incoming class at Michigan of freshmen last year was 43% from out of Michigan. And that's strategic. That's how we pay the bills. If the state were to resubsidize in-state education, then that would shift again. The balance between research and teaching is challenging for us. In many of our departments, the faculty, are probably spending 85% of their time on research, perhaps. And it's tough to educate at scale with the numbers of faculty we can afford to hire, depending on teaching efforts. Regents have this annoying habit, as does the body politic, of trying to interfere with curriculum. So one of my regents, a new regent this past year, was pushing hard on why liberal arts students have to study a foreign language. And he thought that the expertise to address that question was with the Board of Regents. And this is challenging, right? Because they represent the public, and there are many people in the public that say, four semesters of a language to get my kid qualified in foreign language for a liberal arts kind of degree, that's costing me money. That's making my kid stay in school longer. It's not allowing him or her to take courses that might get them a job. So these are real political arguments come in from our governance structures as well. And then finally, this challenge of measuring success, because I think it's critically important to do research that the public appreciates is in their benefit, and we spoke about that, but also to be able to measure in versus out on their students. We should be able to show that over the course of 4 years, we're just not taking an exceptionally qualified student, socializing them, and then sending them out into the world. We're making them smarter, more fulfilled, complete, intellectually interesting, and skilled people as a delta over those 4 years. And we could say it all we want, but until we come up with validated ways to measure it, I think we're going to be having this argument about the value of higher ed. And the only thing people are looking at now are salaries in early and mid-career, which is a terrible metric of how well we've educated these students, right? And at places like Berkeley, at Michigan, oops, I had this discussion with my friends at Princeton. You can't give a student at our schools a test that's going to show a big delta between year one and year four because they're selected for being outstanding test takers on the way in the door. There's no room. So we have to come up with more accurate ways to measure how we're changing them because of this, what I think is a life-altering research university experience. And I'll end by acknowledging the colleagues back at Michigan that let me mooch their data. Particularly driving this is a physicist named Tim McKay, quite an accomplished astrophysicist who's now turned his attention to learning analytics. He was teaching these big intro physics courses, and he figured we should be able to do a better job at this. All right, so look, thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I know I went way too long, so if people have to filter out, I'm not insulted.
Yeah, so Mitchell.
Hi, my name is Mitchell Stevens. I'm a sociologist at Stanford and direct the data policy efforts in the Vice Provost for Teaching and Learning, and know several of the colleagues that you mentioned. And in my estimation, as I look across the country, Michigan is unquestionably setting the standard for how you invest in systematic, scientifically rigorous learning analytics at scale. So bravo to you and for spending so much time on that topic. My question is, how do we get, what are your thoughts about how we get this we, this collective effort that's among multiple universities? How are you thinking about how we might nationally or internationally develop that kind of collective action to move the whole sector in the direction that you want us to go?
Well, you know, I wish I was smart enough to be the guy who said what direction we should all go. But, you know, we're already doing this. So the group that spoke a bit earlier this afternoon spoke of a couple of collective efforts on data warehousing where major universities are just pooling their data. So we're pooling a lot of our learning analytic data with this CIC group, the Big Ten group of big public research universities, mainly in the Midwest. So that is happening already. I think the AAU could really step up and play a role in this, although they haven't really, you know, shown an interest in taking that on. There's a little bit of a challenge, because I think our institutions are a little bit nervous about comparative data between one another. And, you know, somebody was mentioning earlier the private universities, you know, don't like to share their data. You know, you sort of wonder why. What might we see? So, but we're all a little nervous, but I think we just have to get past that. And what I've discovered here at Michigan, it wasn't scholars of education that are driving this. It are scholars, period, from many different disciplines that are researchers in their own field, committed teachers, and they want to take the skills they have to make teaching better. And I think there are groups of like-minded folks around the country who are like that. One thing I'm trying to do is get the Mellon to provide us with some support and legitimacy to get a group from universities together to work on better the Mellon Foundation, better ways to rank or rate universities. This U.S. News thing just absolutely drives me crazy. And absent something legitimate and validated, how can we, you know, tell people they shouldn't look at it, right? There's nothing out there to compete with it. I think if some of the great universities got together and came up with a way to propose and then validate scales of measurement, I'd be willing to take my chances that Michigan might be X instead of Y on a list. I think it would be really valuable.
Other questions?
Yes. So our regents, our UC regents, in their meeting coming up later this month, are going to debate essentially the question, why should we continue to support top-tier research public universities when there exist so many top-tier private universities? And I think you listed three reasons, although I thought your comparison base was not the top-tier privates. It was sort of a more amorphous private set. So with the exception of scale, where I think the argument is legitimate, we have a scale, and that basically is unquestionable. What are the other major arguments that you would make? And let me preface it by saying we cannot use diversity anymore. Our privates are equally diverse with us in every meaningful way. Yep. You can buy diversity, and they do buy. And public mission, it's a little hard to say. I don't understand why the Harvard Medical School has less of a public mission than the Michigan Medical School. So if you take those away, what are the other major arguments that one would make?
Yep. So, you know, that's a very valid and fair question. The way I make the argument is large public research universities localized in states are economic drivers in the state. So we throw off IP. Stanford throws off a ton of IP, but Berkeley throws off a ton of IP. So we do research that keeps the economy growing, innovative, and vibrant at a scale that if the University of Michigan didn't exist, the state of Michigan would be in Silicon Valley making automated vehicles there. So I think that's a very important component. I wouldn't minimize the effect of scale because the great public universities do the vast majority of educating in our country. There are a handful of large, high-quality private universities, but a pretty small handful. You know, Stanford's an obvious great one. But the scale and the throughput and the influence based on the skill sets of the students that are produced, the mass effect of public universities is critical. But I agree with you. I think there's a convergence between the missions of publics and privates. So Ron Daniels, the president at Hopkins, has put out a thought piece saying that the privates are becoming more like publics, taking on, as Hopkins is, a mission trying to lift up economic growth in the city of Baltimore and work on race relations there. They're trying to diversify. As you said, you can buy diversity many different ways. And then the publics are becoming a little more like privates because we're relying lots more on philanthropy now, and we're relying on out-of-state students that pay, in effect, you know, private school-level tuition in many instances. That's an important question.
Other questions?
Steve.
So Berkeley would love to probably be able to admit 43% out-of-state or international students, but because of the political pressure, we're now limited in our ability to take out-of-state international students. So how has Michigan succeeded in convincing the regents and the public that this is a something they should be allowed to do?
So it's really interesting. So the charter for the university predates the state constitution. This board of regents that's popularly elected, governor has no influence over. The only thing the state does is it gives us a budget of general fund dollars. And, you know, right now it's a little bit less than $300 million out of a $7 billion university, right? So they lack really the ability to prevent that. And there have been Supreme Court cases in the state of Michigan showing the autonomy of the Board of Regents when it comes to making those kind of decisions. To be honest, we don't think we can go beyond 50% because I think that's a psychological barrier where, you know, people might be provoked to go for an amendment to the Constitution and really change things pretty dramatically. And we basically show how that number has gone up as the state has stopped providing the subvention dollars, you know, the subsidy dollars. You know, what are we going to do? Then we also make the argument that we're bringing students into the state of Michigan, and some of them are going to stay. That's a good thing. And although we don't make the argument explicitly, implicit in this is that these threefold, which the cost of for an out-of-state student is threefold for an in-state student, in effect, is subsidizing the citizens of Michigan so they don't really have to pay. So I think that the psychology of that is appealing to some people. The admission rate for in-state students at Michigan is about 50%. It's very high. For out-of-state students, it's below 20%. So it's hard to get in, but there's tons of interest.
We have time for one more question.
You talked earlier about managing regional campuses as well that are maybe not as highly ranked. And so can you talk a little bit about the lessons learned from having that ability to look at multiple campuses at the same time?
Yep. So that's actually been one of the hardest parts of my still pretty new job. It'll be 2 years this July that I'll have this job. The reason why is I've never studied or worked at a university like the University of Michigan Flint or the University of Michigan Dearborn. They're very regionally based. They grant few or no PhDs. They're undergraduate and master's oriented institutions. They're not nearly as selective. You know, the caliber of students on a piece of paper who are getting admitted isn't nearly like the universities that we've all worked and studied at. The faculty does a little bit of research and a ton of teaching. The graduation rate, as the feds currently measure it, for Dearborn is about 55%. For Flint is about 35%. For Ann Arbor is 91%. You know, like yours has to be in the 90s too, obviously. So they're very different places. But the best, Dearborn has a very experienced chancellor, Dan Little, who's been there 15 years. And what he told me is, Mark, the mission's very different. The mission is you meet students where they are and you make them 4 years smarter. And I'll tell you, having spent increasing amounts of time in that community on those campuses, the kids value their education incredibly. They work very, very hard. And those kind of campuses really change lives and change families, sometimes maybe even more than the elite research universities do. It has a different function. They have an engineering program at Dearborn. Ford Motor loves hiring Dearborn, University of Michigan Dearborn engineers, because they get a job and they stay. The kids that come from Ann Arbor get a job. If they're not in management in 5 years, then they're going to go somewhere else. So it's just a different, serving different communities in different ways. Interestingly, unlike the UC system, the budget for each of those campuses comes separately from the state. They can set their tuition independently. They report to that same Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents has to approve their tuition request. But the three campuses don't have to be in lockstep.
Yeah. Well, please, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.